I do lots of school visits, lots of library presentations. And something that has come as a bit of a surprise to school teachers and librarians that invite me to speak is that I very rarely speak about my novels at all. And there's a good reason for that. And the reason is, I believe if I have a group of students, say 800 middle schoolers, and I have their attention for 1 hour, I'm not going to spend that time talking to them about my fantasy novels, or my comics, or my art, or the movies. Because they have great teachers, and librarians, and booksellers, and book groups, where they can talk about all those things. If I have the attention of those people for that 1 hour, especially with students, I'm going to spend that time sharing with them the things that I believe are most important, and the things that I believe are most true, which have served me in the course that I have taken in my life. This presentation is something that I put in a nonfiction book called Drawing Out the Dragons. The subtitle is A Meditation on Art, Destiny, and the Power of Choice. And so, like I said, because I'm known for books like Here There Be Dragons, we get a lot of librarians surprised when I basically tell them I'm going to do a motivational and inspirational talk geared towards middle schoolers. But that is something that is very important to me. I believe it's important to convey to people the things that have allowed me to do this for my work. Because I love to do it. I love to tell stories. I love to make illustrations. And there's nothing better in the world than getting to do what you love the most for your job. The choices that I've made in my life and career are what allow me to do that. And so it's some of those things that I want to share with you to get across the message that our lives are nothing but a series of choices. And you always have a chance to choose. And so that in making better and better choices with your lives, we can communicate things. That's what stories are, aren't they? Stories are a way of sharing the things that you believe with other cultures and other communities. And to me, stories are a way of conveying the things that I believe are most important, including the thing I believe is most important for one human being to communicate to another. That magic is real. It exists in the world. And there are people who know how to show you where it is. And I believe in you, and I will not let you fall. Now, I'm a little bit unique in terms of what I do as a novelist because I'm also an illustrator. So I get to illustrate. I do the book jackets, and every chapter is illustrated. And part of that is because of my background in comic books. I'm used to writing and illustrating my own stories. And so I got to illustrate all of the Imaginary and Geographic novels. And I had a bit of a head start in being able to make some of those choices because I was raised in a family of artists. My uncle, my mother's oldest brother, painted Native American Kachina dancers. With his brother, they were partners in a printing company. My mother was a first grade teacher who also illustrated. And their sister was a graphic designer. So I learned everything I needed to learn about art and doing this for a living by basically going to family dinners. But the entrepreneurial spirit kicked in very early too. I've run my own imprint, Copper Bell Press, for more than a quarter of a century. I'm published now with Simon & Schuster, but I still do books like Drawing Out the Dragons through Copper Bell. Now, somebody asked me yesterday, when did you start doing this as a career? How long have you been really working at this? And I said, actually, I started when I was 6 years old. I did little cartoon book versions of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, plus Santa Claus. I'd staple them together, put them in my little red wagon, wheel them around the neighborhood, and sell them to the neighbors for 15 cents a piece. Now, I know for a fact I did this when I was six, because the cover of one that I saw recently said, Goldilocks and the Three Bears, plus Santa Claus by Jamie Owen, age six. Apparently, I felt this was an important marketing point that needed to be conveyed to my readers. I came across this while I was surfing on eBay. I saw a listing for James Owen's first published work. I assumed it would be maybe an old issue of Star Child, something like that. I click on it, and there's Goldilocks. And I thought, I would really love to have that. And it turned out an old friend of mine, childhood friend from grade school, had moved his mother's house from Taylor to Payson, Arizona, found this, put it on eBay. I bid $10 on it. Got the notice, beep, you've been outbid. And then I realized it's the last hour of this auction, and there's several people watching this. So I started bidding it up. I bid it up to $25 and thought, okay, we're good. We get down to the last 5 minutes, somebody starts bidding it up again. I thought, it's a 16-page cartoon book drawn by a six-year-old. So I start increasing the bids. And now there are four other people all bidding over $50. We're down to the last minute. I am frantically trying to figure out what has happened. And trying to determine whether or not I had the greatest fans in the world or these people were out of their cotton-picking minds. Finally, we get down to the last minute. I bid $72 and bing, I got sniped. Sold for $72.50 and I lost it. So I sent a message to the guy that won and said, I don't think you knew this, but this is James Owen that you were bidding against. He sends me back a note, James, oh my gosh, it's Alex, my biggest collector. Neither one of us knew the other's eBay screen names. I said, Alex, if I'd known it was you, I wouldn't have bid you up. And he said, I wouldn't have either. I said, well, you know, I would really love to own that little book if you wouldn't mind selling it to me. And he said, James, I would love to sell it to you, but I have a really complete James Owen collection now. So how about if I send you a scan of it? And I thought that was fine. If somebody was going to own it, it should be somebody like him. But I started thinking about this. We have a handful of people all willing to pay lots of money for a cartoon book drawn by a six-year-old. And it's not that it was that amazing for a six-year-old, but the Santa Claus part was cool. So even back then, I was a fan of mixing mythologies. What made it cool, what made it worthwhile for those people to bid on, was all of the choices I have made since. They retroactively made this thing desirable to these collectors. And that is because all of your choices are cumulative. Every choice you make in your life gives you an opportunity to make a new choice. And you always get a chance to make a new choice. And the sooner you realize that, the sooner you realize your choices are cumulative, the sooner you can start making good choices about everything you do in your life. Now, sometimes those choices come about because of circumstances you cannot control. Sometimes people feel their choices are forced upon them. Sometimes your circumstances are out of your control, but you can always choose how you respond to them. When I was 11 years old, I had a set of circumstances forced on me. I came down with a rare blood disorder that made me very, very ill, made me allergic to everything. I had terrible migraines, terrible allergy attacks. I had to carry a syringe with epinephrine around and learn how to give myself injections. Because if I had an allergy attack, I had about 90 seconds to give myself a shot before my throat would swell closed. It got so bad that I had to be admitted to Good Samaritan Hospital in Phoenix, where I spent a good part of my fifth grade school year. I was allergic to everything. Everything I touched, tasted, smelled, ate. I was allergic to perfume and cigarette smoke, the dog, pizza. That was the real tragedy, being allergic to pizza. And I had to be put in this isolation ward. And they put me in this room that had six beds. I had the bed that was closest to the window. The first week that I was there, the little kid in the bed closest to the door died. The second week that I was there, the kid in bed number two died. About a month after that, the kid who was in bed number three died. And the rest of us got together and had a little secret meeting in the bathroom. Said, okay, we know what's going on here. They've put us in here in order. And if you think that was scary to me, you should have seen the kid in bed number four. But that was when we realized that's why we're in this room. We're the kids that are so sick, they don't know how to fix us. And that's a terrifying thing to realize when you're 11 years old. And so the doctors came in one day, and I kept getting worse. And they told my mother, you know what? We don't know what's making him this sick, and we don't know how to make him better. Maybe you should take him home and make him comfortable, because it's going in a bad direction. And I heard that. Now, I was going a little stir-crazy. They wouldn't let me leave. They finally agreed to let me go down to the gift shop one day a week. Now, I don't know if you've been in a hospital gift shop. Half of it's flowers. So that half is off limits. The other half is mostly get well cards. And it's really depressing to sit and read a lot of get well cards when you can't actually leave the hospital. But they also had books and magazines. And best of all, they had a spinner rack of comic books. And I loved comic books. Loved them all. Superman, Batman, Teen Titans, Justice League. Loved them all. Now, those of you in the back won't be able to see this. Your friends up here in the front can nod and verify this for you. If anybody questions my eternal love of and devotion to comic books, all you have to do is take a look at my wedding band, which is a Superman ring. So, this is pretty deeply ingrained in me. I also have a very tolerant wife. Then one day, with the comic books, a little paperback book came in. A little novel called Superman, Last Son of Krypton. Bought this book, and I absorbed this book. Absolutely absorbed it. And the best part about this book to me was partway through the book, Superman gets poisoned by an enemy from another galaxy. But he gets sick in exactly the same way I was sick. And it gets to a point where he is dying. And he starts having fever dreams. And he has fever dreams about his father from Krypton, Jor-El. And Jor-El comes to him in these dreams and said, "Son, I know you're sick. And I know you think you might be dying. And maybe you are. But I'm here to give you a very important message. And that's this. You were meant to lead an extraordinary life. This is not meant to be the end for you. And if you believe you're strong enough to overcome this, you will. Because this is not supposed to be the end. You are supposed to go and lead an extraordinary life that will change the lives of millions of people. Now, if you don't feel you're strong enough, that's okay too. But you need to know, this is your choice. You get to choose." And of course it's Superman. Of course. He's going to choose. He's going to be strong enough and get better. But I thought about this, thought about it a lot. And there's one personal side here that I'm going to share with this group that I did not put in drawing out the dragons, which is that at the same time I was in Good Samaritan Hospital, my grandfather, who raised me, was in Mesa Lutheran. And he asked to be released. We are active members of the LDS Church. And he said, "I need to give him a father's blessing." And they said, "Well, he'll get out soon, you'll get out soon, we'll get together, we shouldn't take you out of the hospital." And he says, "No, I need to do it now." And they arranged for both of us to get a day pass so my grandfather could give me a blessing, in which he told me, "You get to choose, because I believe that you have a greater destiny than this. That does not mean the pain is over. You are going to have a difficult life if that is what you choose. But it will be difficult because you're going to have a lot of gifts. And your voice will have the ability to move the hearts of men. And it's your choice. If you're not strong enough, that's okay too. But if you choose to do this, you're going to change the lives of millions of people." And we went back to our respective hospitals. And a couple of months later, he died. He'd sent me a letter right after that, which was another list of, "Here are things that you need to know. Here are things that I believe are true." He had one chance to write to me, and that's how he spent that chance. I thought about this, and I slept with that book under my pillow for months. And a doctor there, who who is practicing something called adjunct therapy, that nowadays we call creative visualization, saw my devotion to this book and my belief in what it said. And she says, I want to try something. So for an hour every morning and an hour every afternoon, she sat with me and visualized the Justice League shrinking down to a microscopic size, going into my bloodstream and destroying the bad blood cells while building good new blood cells. And the other doctors in the hospital thought she was a little bit bonkers. But after a few months of this, something started to happen. I started to get better. And I got better enough that they told my mother, take him home for the weekend, but bring him back next week just in case. Then they told her, take him home for a couple of weeks, but bring him back just in case. And then they told her, you know what? We're not sure why. He's better enough that you can take him home, and you don't have to bring him back. Now, I still have to pay attention to things like allergies. I have to pay attention to what I'm around and what I eat. There are still things like migraines. I still have some difficulties with my health, but I've never been as sick as I was then. And the one lesson that I learned in that hospital stay was that none of us knows how much time we have in this life. We get the time we have. And I had seen friends that came in there one day and did not know they would not live another day. And I was determined, I am not going to waste any time. I want to skip over all these steps. I want to become a professional right now. And I decided my career was to be a comic book writer and artist. And I was all 13 years old. So, went home with the help of my mother and my aunt, assembled a portfolio, sent it to DC Comics with a cover letter that said, here I am. I'm your great new discovery. I would like to start on Justice League, but if you need to start me slow on something like Batman, I'm willing to work with you. The editor sent me back a letter and said, you're a nervy little guy, aren't you? And you're a little bit young for us. Maybe when you're older, maybe after high school. I wrote back and said, well, tell me what's wrong with my art. Tell me how to improve. I'll fix it. Then you can hire me. Superman would be good too. Whatever you need. And they'd write back and forth. And I sent packages every week to all the editors. And they got really annoyed with this nervy little kid in Arizona. But I kept sending it. And some would write back and, you know, say, go away. Some would write back with constructive criticism. And my work got better and better. But I realized they're just not going to hire me. Then I came across something revolutionary to me. A magazine-sized black and white comic book called ElfQuest. And I found out that Wendy and Richard Pini, who had created and published this ElfQuest book, they were adults, they were professionals, and they'd been turned down by all the big companies. So they started their own company. And at that point, ElfQuest was selling 85,000 copies an issue. They colored the first 5 issues, put it out as one of the first trade paperbacks to go into any bookstore. And they sold 1 million of them. And I thought, this sounds like a good opportunity. I'm going to do that. So I talked my aunt into driving me to a convention where they were having the end of the Quest, ElfQuest party. My first convention, a world science fiction convention in Anaheim, where I walked around at this party sweating blood for 2 hours before I finally got the nerve to approach the publisher, Richard. And I showed him my art. And he said, you know, this is great. But we're not hiring any artists right now. And I said, I don't want you to hire me. He said, well, we're not making any investments or acquiring any books right now. And I said, I don't want that. And he said, then why did you come all this way to show me your work? And I said, I came all this way to show you my work, to tell you that you inspired me. And I am going to do what you did. And I am coming back here next year as your peer. 14. He pats me on the head and says, yeah, you're a little young, maybe when you're older. And I said, no, I understand, but I'll see you here next year. So I went home, got together with my best friend and said, let's come up with a business plan. You know, we spend a lot of money on comic books, but if we got a tax license like a business had, we could get a wholesale account. And just the money we'd save, the 50% discount, we could put that towards publishing a comic book. And he said, you know, what if we took it to the next level? What if we actually opened up a business? Because that's how businesses work. I said, that's a great idea. So we talked some friends of ours into renting us an old grocery store for $80 a month, where after school, we sold comic books, Louis L'Amour Western paperbacks, and corn nuts. The Corn Nut distributor liked G.I. Joe comic books, so we worked a little barter there. So we'd go to school during the day, then come back, and he'd sell the comics, the Louis L'Amour books, and the Corn Nuts, and I'd start drawing a comic book, and then we realized this is expensive. Rent and utilities and all this stuff, and so we convinced my mother that we had to turn this into a mail order operation, and she had to give us the back end of her house. I'm not sure convince is the right word. I'm being very diplomatic here. It was more along the lines of, hey, Mom, do you know how the back rooms used to look? So we set up our little operation in the back of the house and built up a war chest. And then I realized, even if we have enough money to publish this, how do we promote it? How do we sell it? Where do we go to? And I called my partner and said, we have to go be exhibitors at the San Diego Comic Book Trade Show and Convention, biggest show in North America. And he said, how do we do that? And I said, I think we need to get a bank loan. He says, great. So we got on our bikes and rode down to the bank and walked in with the business plan. And the banker said, well, I can't do this. For one thing, you're too young. For another, most of your profit came from Corn Nuts. And I just don't see it. So we tried all the other banks in the area. We tried a few private businesses. I talked my mother into driving us to places like Sholo and Holbrook so I could hit up the bankers there. I learned not to go to the same bank's branches because it passed around the word by then. Watch out for the two boys. I once talked my mother into trying to drive to the Petrified Forest via Holbrook. Distracted her so she couldn't see the signs. We ended up in New Mexico. She says, we're in New Mexico. And I said, huh, how'd that happen? I should go in and ask directions at that bank. She wondered why I wore my Sunday clothes on a trip to the Petrified Forest. I got turned down by the bank in New Mexico. 42 banks said no to us. And then, finally, I had the first experience of one of the principles that I teach these students. If you really, really want to do something, no one can stop you. If you really don't want to do something, no one can help you. The choice is always entirely up to you. We went to one more banker, and it was actually the first bank we'd gone to. They hired a new manager, and we thought, great, you won't have heard. We walked in and made our presentation to him, and he sat there and looked at us, and then said, I like what I see, I like what I hear, I like what I see in your faces when you talk, and I'm going to give you this loan. To this day, I don't think that loan went through the bank, because it was one piece of paper that I signed that said, I promised to repay this loan. A year later, we got another loan, and there was lots of paperwork involved. So I think this was him deciding to take a chance. And that's the thing. When people see that you believe in what you're saying, they find ways to help you. So he gave us the loan. We got our booth reserved. We got a hotel room reserved. Rented a U-Haul. Got the comic books printed. Hired my aunt to drive us because we didn't have driver's licenses yet. And we became the youngest professional publishers ever to display at the San Diego Comic Book Convention. And this is the comic book that I published. Now, the thing about it is that the lines are the same lines I make now. People look at the art in the Dragons books and say, it's a million tiny little lines. I could never do something like that. And I say, it's the same choices. I was making the same choices back then. I'm better at it now. But I was making the same choices. Lines are just choices. And to share something else with you here, in the credits, I'm credited as the illustrator and writer. My partner and I as the embellishers. He helped me fill in solid black. We both did lettering. Then editorial, I credited my mother, my grandmother, my aunt, and the girl I had a crush on. Politically speaking, I had covered all my bases. Well, at this convention, we found out something very profound. Now, this is back in the days before we had pirate ships and the Batmobile. Everybody had a 10-foot booth and a 10-foot drape table. Over here at Marvel Comics with their 10-foot table and their Fantastic Four comics and Spider-Man t-shirts. Over here, you had DC Comics with their Superman pins and their Batman t-shirts and their Wonder Woman comics. And here in the middle, you had me and my partner and our 10-foot table and our t-shirts and our buttons and our comics. And no one cared how old we were. all they cared about was the work on the table had quality and it was worth paying for. And it didn't matter that we couldn't drive a stick shift. We sold enough to be able to pay off the bills and pay back the loan, but I realized I had a lot to learn about writing and art and publishing and business, and I spent the next several years veering off into other commercial art, learning a lot of things, but getting away from comics. I had the preview of the second issue published, and we never published the second issue. Got older, hired a couple of assistants that were married with kids while I was finishing high school. Graduated, moved to Mesa, set up a studio, was doing commercial art, got married, was trying to expand the commercial part of the studio, and doing a lot of work, but not really happy with it. It was commercial work, it was design work. And then something happened. We were involved with a large printing company that went under, and my wife and I ended up trying to figure out, what are we doing? What are we supposed to be doing? And then I heard from a friend who told me about a great opportunity to be a storyboard artist with the Sullivan Bluth Studio, the animation company that made All Dogs Go to Heaven, An American Tale, Land Before Time. And a storyboard artist takes the script for a movie, lays it all out in pictures in one room so everybody working on the film can see the whole story. And I said, that's comics. I can do that. I want this job. What do I have to do to get it? And he said, that's easy. All you got to do is move to Ireland, because that's where the studio is. And that's a hard decision to make, because it's an expensive thing to move from Arizona to Ireland. We thought about it for a few months, looked at other options, considered what we might want to do, and then decided this is it. We need to pursue this. How do we get me to Ireland? And some friends of ours said, great, we're going to have a yard sale. You can't move all the stuff you have. Let's sell it. So we had a yard sale, and we sold everything. Furniture, extra clothes, pots, pans, utensils, the dog dish. We kept the dog. Everything we had except for my drafting table and my book collection and my wife's sewing machine and the hope chest her grandfather made for her. We got enough money for my ticket to Ireland and one night in a bed and breakfast. My wife went to go stay with her family. My dog went to go stay with my mother. And I took a portfolio, a suitcase, and a briefcase and went to Ireland. Now, Ireland is beautiful and green, and Dublin is a beautiful 1,000-year-old city. So you can sit at the top of Phoenix Park, Big Green Hill, on a park bench, and look down at the spires rising up from the fog. And down there at the bottom of the hill, next to the River Liffey, was a big stone building that was the Sullivan Bluth Studio. And I sat there on that bench and looked out over this vista and thought, this is my grand destiny. This is what I was meant to be doing. To work and live here in this beautiful place and work in that building with people who inspire me, doing the kind of work that I do. This is what it's all been for, is for me to be here in this perfect moment, realizing my great destiny. And I walked down the hill to the studio, and right there in the front door, it's all pictures of dinosaurs, Land Before Time. And I realized I was among my people. I had found my tribe. And every room in that building was the same way. Every room was something to do with artists making great art and people doing wonderful things. And I realized I am one of them now. I get to be with these people. And they toured me up and down the halls and backwards and forwards. And finally, they put me in a little room and said, just wait here. Read the newsletter. Somebody's going to come along and orient you in a little while. But just be patient and wait. And I sat there in that room for 6 hours. Read that stupid newsletter backwards and forwards. Finally, somebody stuck his head in the door and said, are you James Owen? I said, yes. And he says, come with me. There's a meeting. You should be there. And we went to a big, empty room where about 300 artists had gathered together. And a man at the front with a microphone said, I have some bad news for everyone. I'm the financial comptroller for the studio, and we have just lost our funding for our next 5 projects. We are going to have to let go of about 75% of the staff, and it's going to be based on projects and seniority. For those of you that don't know what that means, seniority means the people who have worked there the longest got to keep their jobs. I had been there for 6 hours. After the meeting, I went up to my supervisor and said, I'm James Owen. What does this mean for me? He says, James, it's nothing but good news for you. I've got to deal with all this red tape and paperwork and insurance claims and all these terrible things that they've started now that they're doing this, but you're free to go. So thank you for coming. It was a pleasure to meet you. Good luck with your career. Goodbye. Slam. And I walked back up the hill, sat down on that park bench, stuck my hand in my pocket, and realized that this coin, 1 Irish pound, was all the money I had left in the world. And that's it, and that's all. And I thought, how in the heck did this happen to me? 6 hours ago, everything was perfect. I was realizing my grand destiny. Now I'm sitting on a park bench. I can't even buy McNuggets. How did this happen? And then I realized something very profound. Very few times in our lives do we get to make a choice that changes our entire future. We make little choices all the time. But I realized the next choice I made would determine my entire future. And I got excited because I realized that was a great opportunity. So I made my decision, made the choice. Went down the hill and found a payphone so I could call my wife, collect. Yeah. And said, honey, I've got some good news and some bad news for you. Bad news is we're not moving to Ireland. And there's a lot of things happening. I'll explain that later. The good news is I'm going to do what I should have been doing all along and go back to comic books. That's what I should have been doing. I don't need a studio. I don't need a job. I don't need anyone's permission. I need a pencil and a pen and paper and my own stories. That's what I should have been doing all along. Not quite sure how we're going to do it. I'll let you know. So then I went back down the hill where some friends of mine were leaving the studio to take over all the pubs in Dublin. I said, guys, did you hear the bad news? Or the good news. They're all talking about the bad news. I says, did you hear? He says, James, come drown your sorrows with us, man. And I said, no, I'm celebrating. He says, what's to celebrate about? Well, I just started a comic book company. Hadn't you heard? Really? Guys, did you hear that? James Owen, he's starting a comic book company. Really? Oh, the bastard. He's starting a company. I wish I had the money to do that. Yeah. James, if you hire it, let me know, brother. Guys, did you hear about James Owen? He's starting a comic book company. Wow. And it got around. And it got around to some of the friends I'd made there. And it got around to a member of the church who was the branch president who was in Galway. And he heard about what was going on and heard how I was responding to these choices. And he said, we have to take care of this kid. We have to help him out. So he called the bed and breakfast where I was staying and said, when James Owen gets back there, you let him stay as long as he needs to stay. Let him eat what he needs to eat. And when he leaves, I'll come settle his bill. I spent the week building a business plan for my comic book company. And here was one of those bits of serendipity. The round trip ticket was cheaper than a one way. And we booked a return flight to Arizona for 8 days later that I never planned to use. So I spent the week eating lots of stuff at the bed and breakfast, working on a business plan. Then I flew back to Arizona. My wife got a job selling floor coverings. We got an apartment where we had a drafting table, a sewing machine, a hope chest, a comic book collection, and a dog. With her first paycheck, she paid the rent, utilities, and we bought some art paper and pencils. And I started drawing the first issue of what would become my graphic novel series, Star Child. Now, I've done this before when I was younger, so I knew how to run a comic book company. And I knew I needed to be able to sell at least 1,000 copies right out of the gate to pay the printing bill. And the idea was if we can pay the bills with her job and build this up for a few issues, I can build a readership, make it profitable. So I finished that first issue. We put it in the catalogs. We got the orders back. We'd sold 1,200 copies. So good. Printing bill, pizza money. We put the second issue in the catalogs, and we got the orders back. Not so good. It had sold 600 copies. So we can't even pay that printing bill, which means I can't go on to issue number 3, which means it stopped before it's really begun. But while we were trying to decide how to deal with those circumstances, something else happened that changed every other choice I was making. 1 week after the second issue of Star Child shipped to the comic book stores, I crushed my drawing hand in a car accident. All of you, if you would for me, please, have the students do this. Raise the hand you write or illustrate with for me and spread your fingers as wide as you can. No one has any problems with it, I hope. I'm right-handed. I can't spread those first few fingers. I can't flatten out my hand. My kids are certain I'm Vulcan now. Some young lady made an illegal turn in front of me. My car smashed into hers. My hand on the stick shift smashed into the radio, smashed the radio in my hand, which was sad because I'd finally figured out how to program the radio. They took me to the hospital. I remember trying to push the car out of the way because I was embarrassed. I was blocking traffic. And some fellow in the intersection said, "Dude, sit down. The ambulance is coming. You're hurt." At the hospital, well, the doctors came in and said, "You were really lucky. That was a bad accident. Only thing that got busted up was your right hand. So, you know, as long as you don't need that fully functional for your job." And I said, "Actually, I do. I'm a comic book artist." And he said, "Not anymore, you're not." And they had some doctors come in, and friends and family, and I was cheerfully saying, "Well, we'll heal, I gotta get back to those issues, gotta draw those pages," and they said, "Listen, a positive attitude is a good thing, but you need to face reality. That part of your career is over." And I realized something in that moment. Here was the second time in a year I had to make a choice. Now here's something that I truly believe. I believe that each one of us has something unique to us that no one else is ever going to be able to completely understand. Not your family, your friends, your teachers, your parents. And that is your point of view. No one else will ever completely understand your unique mix of thoughts and hopes and dreams and ambitions and desires. And every once in a while, the universe opens itself up and shows you something that only you are going to understand. And you have to decide in that moment how much you believe in what you see, even if it means telling everyone else in the world that they're wrong. I made my choice. I politely said to the entire world, "You're wrong. And here's what we're going to do." First, said, "Okay, I met with my therapist and I said, listen, I don't need it to be at 100%. I need to be able to draw. So forget 100% usage. We work on 100% of drawing. I don't have to be able to open up peanut butter jars. My wife is very strong. I don't have to be able to tie my own shoes and dress myself. That is what sweats and Velcro are for. I need to be able to hold a pen and pencil." And so for the next 8 months, 4 hours a day, I would be putting screws into blocks of wood and pulling them out again with my thumb and fingers, so I would be able to hold a pen and pencil. Then I went to a Kinko's where I could use a Macintosh computer for typesetting at 10 bucks an hour or 5 bucks an hour if you waved at them with your brace. And I started outlining a story called Star Child Number Zero, and it was a prequel to the other two. And the pages were designed to have a half page of typeset story and a half page illustration that I laid out left-handed, because I had discovered the secret of art, the secret of drawing. It's two parts, very simple, very zen. First part is making lines on paper. Second, choosing where they go. That's it. My right hand had the muscle memory to make those lines, which I couldn't make at that time, but I was choosing here. And if I could use this hand to make the lines, my mind to choose, I could still make those drawings. Now, I couldn't finish them well enough to ink them, to put them in the book, but I called a bunch of other comic book artists that I met and said, "Will you ink these pages for me so we can put out this book, so we can pay our rent, so I can do issue number 3 and continue on with my career?" And the comics industry's attitude was, "Yeah, I promise, but it's over now." The insurance company called around and said, "This wasn't a profession, this was a hobby. We're not giving you a lot of money because you weren't going to make a lot of money. Your own sales dropped 50% after one issue. Nobody's ever heard of James Owen or Star Child." But All these comic book artists said yes, including Will Eisner, who our comic book industry awards are named after, who was doing comics in the 1930s. I said, if you'll do this for me, I'll do one big printing. We'll donate all the art to charity. And they came through. And by the end, my hand had healed enough that I could ink some of those pages myself. We put that book in the catalogs. And when we got the orders back in, people kept ordering them, and kept ordering them, and kept ordering them. And we ended up selling 45,000 copies of this comic book. And suddenly every comic book store in the world knew who I was. And then Jeff Smith, Dave Sim, Colleen Dorn, and Martin Wagner, who were the most prominent self-publishers in comics at the time, said, James, we're doing a tour of the conventions and trade shows. Do you want to come with us and be part of our group? And I did. And that prominence and meeting all those retailers meant when we got the next regular issue of Starchild out, we sold 17,000 of those. I went on to do another 24 issues of Starchild. In various printings, we've sold 500,000 of those comic books. Because of the Starchild comics, I got the attention of an author in Germany who became a huge fan and then started writing to me, and then one day said, I'm editing a series of novels for a publisher here that can't afford me anymore. Would you like to write one? And I said, sure. And he sent me a 3-page outline for what would become the Mythworld series, and I was going to write the second novel in the series. Out of a 1-paragraph outline for my book, I got a second novel that referred to characters and incidents in a first book that had not been written yet. And then I found out that none of the other authors had even started writing the other 6 books. So I bought a case of Diet Dr. Pepper, locked myself in my room for the weekend, and came out with a 20-page outline for 6 more novels. They gave me the rights to the entire series because it was my series now. The first book published won the AI Award for Best Novel that year, came in 2nd for the International Novel of the Year, 2nd behind Stephen King, but I got more votes than Michael Crichton. And writing these books, we published 4 of them, I'd written 5 of them out of the 7, but writing all those books in rapid order gave me the experience I needed. Having done 600 pages of Starchild gave me the experience I needed to be able to write and illustrate Here There Be Dragons. Now there's one more part to this story that I want to tell you before I wrap up here. And I'm going to wrap up with a very simple but profound drawing demonstration. But this part of the story is important to share with you because we have so many professionals in this audience. I don't often share this part with the schools. For you, I'd like you to hear this. I got involved in some magazines. I started expanding. We published a literary magazine and an arts magazine. And they did very well. The first issue of the art magazine had James Christensen on the cover. Sold really well. Then the distributor botched the literary magazine. There was 2 volumes in a slipcase, so it was not cheap to produce. We found out just how badly they botched it when I called one day, and their phones were off. Well, we had several $100,000 worth of product on bookstore shelves across the country. And we found out that they'd had a reorganization and transferred all the assets to another company, and boy, we were out of luck. And 5 magazine publishers went under in a month. And an author friend of mine called me up who knew some of this. I had signed for everything personally, editorial costs, printing costs, distribution costs. And he said, James, you signed for all this. These aren't corporate bills you can write off. You've signed for all this personally. You are in a lot of trouble. What are you going to do? And I said, well, I've considered all my options, and there's really only one thing I can do. I have to write and sell a best-selling novel and then get a movie deal for $1 gazillion. And when I've done those 2 things, I can take care of all these debts, and everything's going to be fine, so don't worry. I've got this. And he said, God be with you, James. And I took all these things and all these outlines and books and comics and put them in my van and headed for California, where I had 9 weeks of nothing. Hardly even any meetings, and nobody wanted anything. And at one point, at my lowest point, my house was in foreclosure, the studio was about to be sold, the utilities were being turned off, I hadn't eaten in a few days because I was saving money for gas, for one more meeting at Disney or one more meeting at Sony. And some publisher called up my brother at the studio and was interested in the Mythworld novels. And then he said, I've also heard about this treatment, something about dragons floating around. That sounds really cool. I'd like to publish that. And my brother gave him my cell phone number. It was a Virgin mobile phone with $14 left on it. He called me up in L.A. and said, James, I want your Mythworld books, but I want this dragons thing. And I think it could be a big seller. And I'm willing, if you'll agree to this now on a handshake agreement, I am willing to overnight you the advance because I know you could use it. Now, that never happens. Those of you authors in the audience, this is not a joke. You really said that. And I needed a lot of money. And the average hardcover advance is about 10 grand. I said, well, what are you willing to offer? And he says, $5,000. And I said, you know, nobody else has offered me anything. I could pay some bills. I could pay my employees. I could pay the utilities. I could get a hamburger. And I can come back and we'll make it up on the movie deal. Because I needed about 20 times that amount. So I said yes. And I borrowed some gas money, headed for home. Everybody at home was getting together because James had a book deal. Let's get together. We'll talk. We'll celebrate. This is going to be great. And I started driving for home. Then he called me back later and said, James, I'm so excited. I made the arrangements for The Wire. You're going to be so thrilled. It's going to be beautiful. Beautiful paperback book. I said, well, it's got to be a hardcover. He said, James, I don't think we can sell more than about 5,000. That's a great number. But I know you could use the money. Tell you what, I'm going to send you 6,000 bucks. I said, if you do it in hardcover, I'll take 4. And we argued about this all the way to Blythe, which is a terrible place to be arguing about your whole future. And he was up at $9,500 if I would just say yes. I was down to $2,500 if he would just do it as a hardcover. And then, and I know I'm running over a few minutes here, but this is the part I came here to tell you about. Then I made the hardest decision I've ever made in my life. And I told him no. Because of one principle I believe more than any other, and it's this. And if this is the one thing you take away from this conference, please remember this. Never, ever sacrifice what you want the most for what you want the most at that moment. Never sacrifice what you want the most for what you want the most at that moment. And I told him no. And then I spent the next 6 hours dialing his number and hanging up. Well, I tried to figure out what to tell my friends and family. And I got home and got them together and told them what I'd done. And I said, you have trusted me so far. Trust me now. This is the right decision. Trust me in this. We'll figure out a way to make this work. Trust me. And they said, okay, we will. And about that same time, a friend of mine showed up at the door, a guy that runs an oil company and raises racehorses. And he says, hey, I heard James got his book deal. I'm here to celebrate. We said, you'd better sit down. And we told him what had happened. And he said, okay, well, get your rear end back to L.A. Go get the right deal. And he said, as soon as we can figure out how to pay off some of these things and get me there, we will. And he says, well, how much did you turn down? I said, $9,500. And he sat down and wrote me a check for $9,600 and handed it to me and said, these people trust you for a reason. They trust you because you made the right choices. And I'm going to trust you, too. And I need you to know your friends have got your back. And we believe in you. And we're not going to let you fall. His father was the banker who gave me that first bank loan when I was 15 years old. All of your choices are cumulative. If you believe enough in yourself, if you believe in the things that you say you want to do, people see it in your face, they hear it in your voice, and they find ways to help you. Now, kind of about 5 minutes over my time, I'm going to beg your indulgence for about 3 minutes more because I have something I'd like to show you. I've told you about this story. Some of you have seen the illustration work in my books. And I've told you the secret of drawing. I'm about to demonstrate. People look at the covers for my books, say that's a million tiny lines. I could never draw something like that. I said, actually, you can. Everyone can draw a dragon like this because you know the secret of drawing. It's making lines on paper and choosing where they go. If you know how to start those lines, this dragon starts with four lines. Anyone can make four lines. And that's why we need to share the things that we believe in. Lines and choices, they're the same thing. Show somebody how to make those simple choices. They can make the rest of the choices themselves. So, dragon, starting with four lines. Four lines. No big deal. Let me add three more. Still no big deal. Let me add just a few more. Now we're starting to get the shape of it. Let me add just a few more. All right, just 30, 40 seconds, just a dozen lines, and I've already got the shape of the head and the neck. I'm going to jump right into this. It's going to take me about 2 minutes to do. But when I step back away from this board, there's going to be a finished drawing of a dragon that all of you saw me start with four lines that everyone in this room can draw. Now, while I'm finishing this drawing, I want you to think about the things I've shared with you today, specifically those things that I wanted you to remember. I started out first by saying, if you really, really want to do something, no one can stop you. If you really don't want to do something, no one can help you. But the choice is always entirely up to you. Second, I'd like you to think about those choices I made, especially sitting on that park bench in Ireland. Are you the kind of person that things happen to, or the kind of person who makes things happen? Do you just respond to your circumstances, or do you realize those moments are opportunities to choose to do something extraordinary, to change your entire future, to do something great with your life? But most of all, I want you to remember the last thing I shared with you. It's the most important decision that I use on a daily basis about every decision I make. Never, ever sacrifice what you want the most for what you want the most at that moment. And if you hesitate, just imagine you've already made the choice. Your reaction to that will let you know whether it's the right decision. And it's not always the easy decision. More often than not, it's the hard one. I think about that a lot, about that drive from California. That was the hardest choice I've had to make about my career. But because I'd made the right choice, when Simon & Schuster came along, the first printing of Here There Be Dragons in hardcover was 100,000 copies. It's now in its sixth hardcover printing. It's in its eighth paperback printing. The books are being sold in 26 countries around the world. And my first movie deal was with the Harry Potter producers. The current producers working on it made The Lord of the Rings. And everything about my career and the reasons I'm here speaking to you today happened because in that one moment, I made the choices that were the most important, that didn't sacrifice what I wanted most. And the thing about it is, you can say you're going to draw a dragon starting with four lines, and people will look at you like you're nuts. But if you just do what you know is true, do the things you believe in, keep making your right choices, keep making the lines, sooner or later, you will have made enough of the right lines. Sooner or later, you will have made enough of the right choices that you can stand back from what you're doing and everyone can see you were drawing a dragon all along. And that is all I have to share with you today. I have to say thank you.